Canto 2, Chapter 4, we'll cover texts 23 and 24. Process of creation. The question that Maharaj Prithvi has put before Shukadev Goswami is, how does the Lord perform creation? Process of creation. He's understood that there is a source, and that's Krishna. Everything comes from Krishna. That he's also understood. Spiritual, material, everything comes from him. And the material world is periodically manifest, sustained for some time, and then withdrawn. So how does he do this? What's the process that's followed? It's not that Krishna is restricted, this is unlimited. But at the same time, in an orderly fashion, Krishna does things, particularly with material creation, and he chooses that order, and so he wants to know, how does it happen? What's the way, what's the process? So, in these verses, we're hearing Shukadeva Goswami giving his answers in the form of prayer, praying to the personality of Godhead in a variety of ways. And through that prayer, he's accomplishing a few things. One of them is his submission is repeatedly being deepened from in that second thing is in that submission, he's appealing for the Lord to be pleased with him, for the Lord to give him the capacity to illumine the heart of Maharaj Prithvi. So he's reconfirming his dependence and appealing to the Lord for allowing him or enabling him to be a head instrument. And the third thing is he's revealing features of the Lord, the characteristics of the Lord, through which he carries out the process of creation. He's disclosing how it happens that way. The essential message is that he does through the agency of the potencies. The Lord has unlimited and inconceivable potencies, and he invokes some of those potencies to do this, and he invokes some of his potencies to do that, and then he transfers that potency or some of those potencies to the living entity, and that's the process of creation. That's what he's describing here. We've already heard, and then the theme repeats itself in this verse about Vyam Pati. Several verses. Vyam Pati is the Lord of intelligence. Vyam Pati. So he illumines the pure devotee's heart to understand him. He illumines the heart of Brahma and Shiva and the heads of the Sampradayas in order to understand him enough at least to explain through their teaching. And he illumines the heart of the non-devotee to pursue material activities with material intelligence. Like in the fourth canto, the Puranjana story. It's an allegory told by Narada, the king for Jindavani. It follows this. In order to help the king, Jindavani, who was very pious, but attached to the enjoying spirit, and thereby attached to the fruitive activities portion of the Vedas, he very eloquently described an allegory, the allegory of a king. That's what the allegory was. It was him. That was one king named Brahma. And he had everything, almost. He didn't have happiness. So he was searching for happiness, searching for happiness, searching for happiness. One time, he was in a garden. He saw the form of a beautiful woman who was bouncing the ball in the garden, and he became mesmerized with the movements of the form, the movements of the bouncing ball, long tresses of hair, and other kinds of graphic descriptions of the body movements, and he just swooned. He was enamored. And that, when he explains the allegory, that woman in the garden is material intelligence. Through the medium of material intelligence, I can get. So the living entity, through the agency of Dhyanapati, is awarded material intelligence so that they can try to enjoy. Of course, may not get the enjoyment that they were hoping for, nor may they necessarily get all the features of the material intelligence they hope for, but you know, at least it's some hope they can enjoy the material intelligence. And then it turns out to be a pretty tricky arrangement, because material intelligence sometimes delivers suffering instead of happiness. So, Dhyanapati, that's the same Dhyanapati, is not only Dhyanapati, but he's Yajnapati and Prajapati, and he's the Lord of everything. So, having established that in text 23, Shukadeva Goswami prays, may the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who enlivens the materially created bodies of the elements by lying down within the universe, and who in his Purusha incarnation causes the living being to be subjected to the 16 divisions of material modes, which are his generator, be pleased with my statements. Well, the Prabhupada has translated this as a sandwich verse. May the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in the middle part, be pleased with my statements. And the middle part is, he enlivens the materially created bodies of the elements by lying down within the universe. So he's now speaking about Prabhadaksha and Vishnu. There's the universe which Mahavishnu expands into and lies down within the universe. So there's some steps that he's eliminated. He just hasn't discussed them. There's the pradhan state and glance of Mahavishnu, giving enlivenment to inert matter, the Chaya Devi, the reflection of Brahma Devi. She becomes animated and activated by contact with the glance of Mahavishnu. And so now there's the material ingredients, and by his exhaling, the seeds of universes generate from his body, amalgamating around the seeds are the elements nurturing those seeds, and so they grow. The universe expands into the universe, as Bhavadakshaya Vishnu mentioned here, thus enlivening the material elements. So the glance sends living entities. He enters within the universe personally. So the point is, there's the touch of spirit. Creation, the process of creation works because there's the touch of spirit. And where does that spirit come from, or what's the position of spirit in relation to matter? It's two things. It's in relation to matter, spirit is the source of generation. That is, Mahavishnu, amongst his numerous potencies, unlimited potencies, he expands the elements. So they're extension from him, like rays of the sun from the sun. They're extensions of the sun. The elements are extensions from him. They're part of his energies. So the energies are there, so there's contact with the Lord for that, because of emanation from him, but they're called Dina Prakriti, or separated energies. Dina Prakriti. So he then enhances that separated energy by the touch of spirit through the living entities. And then he personally enlivens. So there's two enlivenment sources, two spiritual contacts, by his Bhavadakshaya Vishnu and by the living entities. In this way, he enlivens the materially created bodies of the elements by lying down within the universe, and second, and who in his Purusha incarnation causes the living entities to be subjected to the 16 divisions of material modes, which are his generator, material modes which are his generator. So Prabhupada explains this in the purport, that the 16 principal creative elements, namely the Panchabhuta, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and then 5 knowledge acquiring senses, 5 working senses in the mind, that's 16. He manifests them, and then he shares that with the living entities, or he enables the living entities to take advantage of those 16. Here in the verse it says he causes the living beings to be subjected to, it's not like they go through the shopping center and pick out, you know, the 16 off the shelf and go to the cash register. They're provided without any effort from their side. It's the Lord's arrangement. And what's the purpose behind the arrangement? The material elements were created for the enjoyment of the living entities. So he's reciprocating. They want to enjoy separate from him. Can't enjoy separate from him. There is nothing separate from him. You meditate on nothing, like that last night. Meditate on nothing. Bhaktisiddhanta says very succinctly, there is no void in the creation of the Lord. The very idea of in the creation of the Lord, Lord means he's created it. So void means nothing. So it's a contradiction of terms. That which is created doesn't have an absence of anything. There's a presence of something. There's no void in the creation of the Lord. So it's either the Lord or His energies, and not the absence of the Lord and or His energies. So the living entities wish to enjoy separate from the Lord, well, there is no such thing. So we have to have an illusion that there is such a thing. So he stands as illusory energy, covers the living entities with this whammy that they can think there is existence apart from the Lord, and I'm going to meditate on that. Then the next statement is, while he provides that arrangement, he remains apart or aloof. So he's benevolent, but aloof. Now aloof generally means, I don't care. But that's not the Lord's position. That's not what real, the aloofness of the Lord in any case. It's, he doesn't involve himself with that arrangement because, factually, it's a delusion. And, factually, there is no enjoyment there. And he's not going to go there and try to enjoy side by side. Hey, I'll be your friend. I'll hang out. We'll try to enjoy together. I'm your friend. We'll try to enjoy illusion together. He's a loop. But he makes the arrangement. Simultaneously, and primarily he's benevolent. But this detachment from that, the enjoyment of illusion program, he doesn't involve himself with it directly. He just makes the arrangements, sets it up, and he oversees it purposefully so that the this, like, die-hard hope that I can enjoy apart from Krishna can, we can get some lessons out of that. It's not going to happen. It's not meant to be. It's not a natural position. Prabhupada writes, the beautiful arrangement behind all material manifestations is therefore made possible by the energy of the Lord, and the individual living entity can only pray to the Lord to understand it properly. So this is dhyampati. If the Lord is so kind, he can enable me to understand how this is happening. But then we also have to accept him as yajnapati. While we're making sacrifices, he's the Lord of that too. We're checkmated. He's got us at all sides. But it's good. It's not like, I don't like that. That's good. The material spirit is rebellious, and the devotional spirit is affectionate and attentive and happy. So in that position, then all of one's activities become sanctified and spiritually less, intelligence and so forth, everything, all aspects of life. Then one can understand the creation and one's relationship with the Lord while in creation, and act with mind absorbed in the Lord, intelligence, understanding the Lord, always seeing in the background the causal effect. If he's so pleased, so even Shukadeva Swami, who does understand all these things, is in this prayerful mood. Prabhupada comments that Shukadeva Swami prays for the mercy of the Lord, not only for the help personally in presenting the truth, but also for helping others to whom he would like to speak. Very nice. So, it's so that I can transparently represent you, but beyond that, so that those that I interact with can be factually benefited, and it's because of you. It's this dependence and compassion. And even for the fulfillment of compassion, dependence and compassion. Speaking about this yesterday, but to say it again, this is really wonderful, getting an inside look at the feelings of Shukadeva Goswami through the page of the Srimad Bhagavatam. How does he approach his devotional service? What's the internal psychology of Shukadeva Goswami? Very confidential. At the beginning, the very introductory statement of the purport, Prabhupada writes, as a fully dependent devotee, Shukadeva Goswami, unlike a mundane man who is proud of his own capability, Shukadeva Goswami invokes the pleasure of the personality of Godhead so that his statements may be successful and he may be appreciated by the hearers. The devotee always thinks of himself as instrumental for anything successful to be carried out, and he declines to take credit for anything done by himself. Prabhupada chose to put that at the front end of the purport. And he chose to put it at the end of the purport. So, more important than the information is this mood of service. When the mood of service is right, then empowered hearing, empowered speaking, empowered whatever it is, the service that one's doing, by the grace of the Lord, becomes possible. It's immaterial existence, abandonment of ego, is people don't struggle with it, struggle with ego. They know that it's a problem, but at the same time, what do you have if you don't have ego? And you win. You're like this wet noodle. You're useless. People will walk all over you, and you can't do anything because you gotta have a little of that spirit. So that's because they think like that, although they struggle with ego, because they really don't know what the alternative is. In this presentation I'm going to be making at MIT, there's some studies that have been done to be presented. 5 years of studies of some people on, you know, what makes superlative businesses as opposed to mediocre or even somewhat successful businesses. And the book that they've written is called Egonomics. That how they manage ego determines super success or mediocre success or failure. So, you know, but dollar signs in front of messages that people pay attention. Of course, they don't come to a spiritual conclusion, but they do speak about the merit of having this, you know, passion, they use the word, for doing something, achieving something, being in the mode of passion about being really prudent about something, and then somehow in this balance being exceptionally humble so people can manage to balance those two things. That's when people, that's when organizations or individuals or companies are superb. They have an astonishing capacity for humility at the same time. So, no. All of you know from practical experience as well as from scripture, that's like watching cloud formations in the sky. How long does a cloud hold a particular formation in the sky? Not long. So it's not substantial. There are cloud formations in the sky, there's a pussycat. And then the pussycat becomes a tiger. Or something, some terrible thing. So one sense is pleasing, the next moment it's, you know, fearful. And people become like that too. There may be some slightly longer durability of the pussycat feature, but it changes. And for the most part, whatever it is, it's not substantial. And that's the whole, that's the message of illusion. It's insubstantial, and even the appearance of the insubstantial thing is temporary. Because the modes of nature are always changing. Contrastingly, the position of spiritual consciousness is, because there's factual shelter, it's not only durable, it's constitutional. It doesn't change. Like one of the students was asking last night, the American fellow who asks a lot of questions. Is it possible to in exactly the context of this question, something from his reading from Bhagavad Gita, you were discussing Bhagavad Gita, about context, I can't remember, but something about lower modes, and is it possible to, like, just go beyond them? But where the diminishing influences of our consciousness are surpassed. Troubling disturbances of the head of distance. It doesn't affect me anymore. And the answer is, yes, only if you actually contact transcendental shelter. And Prabhupada's example, I didn't give this last night, but he gives the example of a rocket ship. So to send a rocket ship into outer space, so much energy has to be expended. You've overcome the force of gravity, but when it takes off, and overcomes the force of gravity, it's off into outer space. But how long can it stay in outer space? After some kind of fuel runs out. Unless it can take shelter to some place where there's a natural atmosphere and it can reside someplace, eventually you have to come back. Run out of oxygen, run out of food, run out of fuel, run out of life-sustaining things, you have to come back. It's the same way. One can, by some means or another, try to overcome the forces of nature that cause us to struggle so much. But unless you take shelter in Spelfa's point, you can't stay there. You have to come back. And again, struggle. So from the get-go, the outset, one should consider, what is that place, having once taken shelter there, you don't have to return to the place of struggle. That's a thoughtful person. Why not choose that path to travel on that will take me to the place where there's no struggle anymore? Because there's no shelter. You can't stay. That's the that's not a place to strive for. So, the contrasting position is the godless atheist who wants to take credit for everything, and the ego, the whole game is bluffing. So Vedic truths are not dependent upon bluffing. The Vedic truths are dependent upon humility and receiving, descending, perfect knowledge. The Vedic truths are all perfect descriptions of the factual truth without any mistakes or illusion. Now Shukadeva Goswami has received that from Vyas, and he wants to be really careful to not mess up, to not take that perfect something and modify it in a way. So Shukadeva Goswami wanted to present the truths of creation not as a metaphysical theory, a philosophical speculation, but as the actual facts and figures of the subject. So, metaphysics. Well, that's like a child's playground for intellectuals. They go all over the place, run around and jump and skip and hop and do all kinds of antics in the field of metaphysics. Watch this one. Da 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 da. And then, wow, that was really good. You must be really solid in there. Without really having any basis of knowing anything. So, this is not like that. It's not born of speculation. It's come in this descending fashion. And one of the features that we find always, without exception, are these characters, qualities of Shukadeva Goswami. Very humble. Very dependent. Very careful to not, in this case, with respect the personality of God, but the next case is respecting the person that he received his knowledge from, namely us. Since Shukadeva Goswami would be dictated to by the Lord exactly in the same manner as Brahmaji was inspired, dictated to by the Lord. Passed on to Narada, passed on to Vyasa, passed on here to Shukadeva Goswami. So there's this integrity, or great, meticulous care to present unchanged. If you have people that don't have integrity, then you've got a problem. The character is of, it's essential for the Vedic wisdom to be properly preserved. So that's the main idea that Prabhupada presents in this first paragraph. And then he wants us to understand the life comes from life principle. So the empathy is the intelligence becomes enlivened, but then the material elements also become enlivened by spiritual contact. Otherwise it's inert matter. It's all matter. It appears to be alive or animated. You know, the trees are growing, the birds are flying, and, you know, life is going on. Because the touch of spirit, we don't see it, and we don't have the capacity to unless enlivened to do so. So the intelligent man can see without mistake that any material creation, whether one's own body or a fruit or a flower, cannot beautifully grow up without the spiritual touch. The greatest intelligent man of the world, or the greatest man of science, can present everything very beautifully only insofar as the spirit life is there, or insomuch as the spiritual touch is there. He uses this phrase, spiritual touch, over and over. Therefore, the source of all the truths is the Supreme Spirit, and not gross matter, as wrongly conceived by the gross materialists. Just, you know, what modern science says, it's not a new program. It's just a rewrite of an old program. And of the atheistic theories, no, it's karma is the principle, or the atom is the principle. Everything comes from atoms combining, so atom is, that's fundamental. That's the source of everything. Not a new idea. And they, you know, they've justified this in their own way by reference to things from the Vedas. Everything, but just see how abundant the explanation is on the personality of God. It's not just spirit. So common sense says life comes from life. The scriptures also say, we get information from the Vedic literature, that the Lord himself first entered the vacuum of material universe, and thus all things gradually developed one after another. Similarly, the Lord situated as a localized Paramatma, and every individual being, hence everything is done by him beautifully. So, how does he do it? It's life comes from life, and he generates matter, and then arranges for that matter to then kind of like nurture the bodies of living entities so that their desires can be fulfilled. Their intelligence is there. Here's how you use the body to fulfill your desires. Go for it. In the next verse, he's respecting, he's offering this as he's been praying to the Supreme Lord and praying to the Sri Vyasadeva. The incarnation of Vasudeva compiled the Vedic literature. Prabhupada spends time with this. Vedas say, the compiler of the system of transcendental knowledge, and he refers back to this, the Yambhati. What's the purpose of Vedic knowledge? It's to revive the memory, the lost memory of the conditioned souls about their eternal relationship with the Lord. So you can say the purpose of the Vedas is to know Krishna. Another way of saying the same thing is this Dhyanbhati. As the incarnation of Vasudeva, Vyasadeva is reviving that lost memory of the conditioned soul. Their capacity to properly fix their mind upon the Supreme. When the mind is fixed upon the Supreme, it becomes cleansed, and thus the intelligence can be elevated to the spiritual platform and understand the Lord. So he's offering his prayers to Vyasa. Any discussion?
Can you please explain that point in utilizing on this part? Can you feel that Mahavishnu glances in that hand? And you also see that Ramadevi is activated by the glance of the humanist.
There you go. Rama Devi is the consort of Mahavishnu. Rama Devi has a reflected portion of her called Chaya Devi. otherwise known as Pradhan. Mahavishnu, enjoying with the Mahadevi, saw Sharadevi was nothing to do. Wishing to enliven her, to give her something to do, just by his glance, he gives her a lot to do. Thus enliven her by his glance. That's all she needs, a glance. She's ready to go. Yes. You got it. Otherwise known as and can be in the inactive or the active state. Still is chaya, is reflection. As the, you know, the material creation is a reflection of the spiritual realm. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15. How we should do our service. How they do gives us a clue how we should do our service. Gap between receiving inspiration and then acting on it by speaking or I'm not sure what you're asking, because there may or may not be a time delay. We're always doing something, just like Prabhupada received inspiration from Bhakti Siddhanta from the first meeting that they had. There was a delay. But he held that inspiration, and you could say incubated that inspiration. And at the right time, he executed. But he considered he was preparing executing. So there may be a delay in that sense, but it's not that the thought escaped him, or you know, the inspiration escaped him. And something about inspiration is that the series of conscious steps may not be, you know, visible. You know, unknown to the inspired person is how all the steps take place. Common inspiration. You know, the way that Sadhguru explains this is when you're doing solving a mathematical problem, there's a very logical step one leading to the next, leading to the next, leading to the next. You can't go from the preliminary one to the final one without all those steps. It just doesn't happen, nor does it make sense. It's not approved. But there may be some inspiration that all of a sudden it all fits together, and all of a sudden you didn't go through the logical bring the mind to the next step, connecting it to the next one. It's just or another comment, like a artistic person or music creative person, all of a sudden some inspiration without the clear thing of steps, like Mozart describes the whole thing just starts to unfold in his mind, connecting one part and another part and the whole, and he just goes and writes it down. There isn't any logical step effort, it just happens. Flooding his mind on a nice morning walk. So, how my point with that is that inspiration may not have all of the steps, which wasn't exactly your question, but certainly one can hold inspiration without immediately acting on it. But by the very nature of inspiration, one can have this feeling or sense that it's from another source. You're like a vessel receiving that something. And you know, at least if you're consciously carrying that inspiration, it's going to come out even subliminally, without any direct words or actions, because it's a move, an inspiration. So you can have a quiet, inspired person. Is that what you're looking for?
For me, the bothers the tendency to immediately act.
Okay.
And I always feel rejected when I see that what I'm acting is more important.
Yeah. Then it's impulsive. And it's not, it's not going to sustain either. There's no problem immediately acting. There's no problem in choosing the right time, place, circumstance for exhibiting that inspiration. But in either case, it should be sustained. And one way of describing the difference, or a means of sustaining inspiration, is that it comes from the heart, not from, immediately to the mode of nature. Mode of passion, I've got to do something. So, aside from the modes of nature, like distant, detaching yourself from the modes of nature, act from that inspiration, as Sri Kadeva Swami is doing, he's retaining that sense of dependence, that sense of being an instrument, that sense of wishing the Lord to empower him. He's staying connected to that source of inspiration as he's speaking. It need not be explicitly articulated every sentence you speak, but it should be part of the consciousness that you carry. Then it's not, impulse. It's more deep. It's something that has touched your heart. You have reflected upon where this touching of your heart has come from as an expression, initial expression of gratitude for that which, the way in which your heart has been touched, your giving. But then that giving can continue because of the sense of your heart, you're reacting from the heart, reacting from the soul. Otherwise, it's circumstance prompted, circumstances acted, and it's gone. Then I need the next inspiration. Because I'm feeling empty. What happened? The fizz is gone. That's artificial. I mean, its response is artificial. It's not necessary. That's not disgenuine, but it's not from the right platform.
Maharaj, I would like to submit a question from a student from Boston University recently posted.
Okay. Was it related to this?
Kind of.
Okay.
So she was making the point, she was asking me, what is wrong about being sad? Like, we talk about being always happy.
What's wrong with being sad?
She's quoting like recent book that has come out of Mother Teresa. She says Mother Teresa was spiritual, but she had a very dark, she had some dark periods, which was, it was okay. And this kind of thinking, it seems to me, it's becoming more prevalent because people are now discerning to this duality in a different way, like there is happiness, sadness.
To answer questions like this, that particularly ones that you know they're coming from the world somewhere and land on your table, you just go back to fundamental things. Well, Bhagavad Gita 101, it's there's sat and there's asat, and you start from that one point. Now the sadness of the gopis when Krishna left. When Krishna left to go, herd the calves in the forest with the cowherd boys, the residents of Braja were sad. But that's a transcendental feeling. And, you know, the feelings of temporal sadness, you need not, you know, evaluate where Mother Teresa had. You just describe principle. So there's nothing transcendental emotion of all variety. What is it? The ecstasy of separation is the highest thing in our teachings. But dark periods of sadness is another thing. Let's go to the realm of sat and look at things from that lens. So, a worldly person passing through a dark period, that's unfortunate. It may lead to, as an impetus, to take deeper shelter of sat. So then you're like using a thorn to rule a thorn. And that's the right use of the lessons of life. But in and of itself, sadness doesn't have value. Anything that brings one to further shelter the personality of Godhead and absorption in him, that has value. From a sat perspective.
Just to mention, you know, that the
Prabhupada has described that so many times. It's like a loving parent, where a child may do something that's not ideal, but knowing the child has free will, the parent may make some arrangements. With the purpose, in Supreme Lord's case, purposefully putting into the package the remedy. Just like the question was just asked, if there's a situation of suffering, there's a purpose behind that, there's something to be learned. Now, if the living entity chooses to not learn that lesson, that's their choice. But you can say it's reluctant. Prabhupada gives the example, sometimes a wealthy person puts his disobedient, mischievous son in charge of a strict disciplinarian to train him. How does the father feel about that? It's benevolent. And real happiness is when that rebellious spirit subsides. That's how we feel from this. Poor living entity is suffering unnecessarily. Thank you very much. Should have qualified for example.